Welcome to this lecture on program optimization. So we looked at alias analysis, in fact, but we did not do alias analysis in the last lecture, but we did points to analysis. So we try to determine for every program variable and every abstract address to which other addresses they may contain as values. And so this was so we used essentially sets of addresses as values. And now again we did not deal with concrete addresses like the address 3596,000 and so on, but we used abstract addresses, and that were allocation points. So that was our choice. And we had two versions of that points to analysis. One where we, for every program point, determined that information. And our observation was, okay, so for program variables like X, Y, Z, the sets which we have at different program points may be different, yes, but for the values of addresses, we only could realize non-destructive updates, that is, the values there in the course of fixed point iteration will simply grow larger and larger. And that that means we have the information which we have at different program points may not be so different. And so our decisive idea was, okay, if the results do not differ so much from one program point to the other, why not take a radical point of view and compute only one information? This is... So that means one information, that is, we have for every program variable one set, giving all the potential addresses which might ever be stored into that variable, and the same for every address. So in that sense, it is not an invariant which for every program point, but one global invariant which holds for during all, which kind of describes everything whatever goes on during computation. And this kind of global invariant, how can one prove? Now we stopped last time with the question, this is a different type of invariant, is it more difficult to prove its correctness? And the answer is somehow no. It is very simple to prove its correctness. Before that, so as usual, we have the concrete semantics as our baseline formalism with respect to which we have to prove correctness. And so we have to consider the situation, what happens if we do one step from one concrete state to the other. And in the old days of abstract interpretation, you recall there was a description relation here to some abstract state here, and there was a description relation to some, there was an abstract state here, and we had an abstract step here. So that was the way how we, and then we proved that this kind of rectangle commutes, that is, if I make a step, if I start with something which is in the description relation, I do a step in the concrete and in the abstract, and then the description relation is preserved. Now that was the picture which we had before, and now we simplify that picture. Now we have only a single state, this one, which we compute. And the only thing is what we have to guarantee is that this is invariant under steps. So that is, if I have a state S, which is described by this invariant, and I do a step, and I reach another state, then this again should be described. And then, by induction, I find, oh, then every state, if the initial state is described, then all successive states also will be described. Yeah? So that is the idea, and now one could say, okay, so in some sense, we throw everything into one pot. There are some critics who would say that is no hope in retrieving any useful information. But that's true, yes, but only partly true, because usually programmers tend to not use the same X, the same variable X, for all kinds of different things in the program. At least this is bad programming style. You calling all the every variable X and every pointer P. So if you do that, then you are kind of punished in some sense, because then the information will be bad. But if you have different pointers, different sorts of pointers in your program for different purposes, and you give the variables for them different names, then the analysis will keep them apart. That is one thing why this kind of very coarse analysis still might not be too bad. And there's another reason why it is not might not be too bad, because there is, and we will later see it, there's something like a static single assignment form. You have heard of that? Which is the base of many infrastructures, many compiling infrastructures, in particular the LLVM infrastructure. And that kind of is a static transformation which one does beforehand, which tries to disambiguate variable names right from the beginning. So if it were single assignment, that means every variable receives only one assignment. And here it is, this is not always possible because due to loops, but you could at least come very close to it, and that is the essence there. And if every variable is assigned to at most once, or just once, then this flow insensitive analysis is as good as anything. Yeah, so therefore, this is also one might the first impression might be that this is a very stupid way of analyzing the program. In fact, it is not. When people do points to analysis, then virtually always they do this kind of points to analysis. Okay, so now still one has to compute with these sets and iterate over the full program. And if you are interested in alias analysis, then in fact you are not so completely interested in finding out what kind of an address really one points to. You only want to know, may these two pointers point to the same thing, whatever that be. Yeah? So that is the question, could one compute this alias information directly? And could that information perhaps be computed more quickly than doing the points to information, which is more precise in some sense? How could one do that? And that is, what is alias? So the alias is of pointer expression. So I want to know, I have this pointer expression and that pointer expression. Is it possible that at runtime they evaluate to pointers which are the same? So that's the question. And so that is kind of an equivalence relation, if you like, on variables and memory locations. So that was kind of stupid thing. So here is the variables. Here are the memory locations. Recall that we kind of ignored the offsets inside the blocks. So we want to know, is it possible that X contains a reference to a block which also is stored inside the block pointed to by Y? Yeah. So, and if that is the case, I would kind of install an equivalence relation between X and Y, and the block pointed at by Y. Yeah. So let's see this. Let's look at that particular program here. So here is a little program. So in the beginning, X points to does not share anything with any other pointer. Then comes the Y, And then still, neither X nor Y, nothing is shared. Then the Y moves into the X. And that is the Y. That means that the Y, I should make it in here, might point to the same thing as something inside the block pointed to by X. Yeah? Because everything what you put into Y later will become, will possibly be also pointed at by the something inside the block X. Yeah? So, and that also, yeah, you could also say, yeah. And then there is, and then in the end, and then, so X is not shared, does not share anything with anything else. The Y might be shared with something which is inside the block of X, and in the block of Y there is nothing. So therefore this is unshared. So you see here that in the end we have three equivalence classes. So these, sorry. So here, so three classes. This, the X forms one class, the Y and the block of X forms another, and then the Y, the block of Y yet another. So we have three equivalence classes, and these are kind of always. So whenever you have, this is, it holds at program exit, but it is also, this alias information describes the situation throughout the whole program. Yeah. So that. So now, what is the kind of the idea of all that analysis? So the first thing is we compute one single information for the whole program, like this flow insensitive points to information. The result of the computation is a partition of this of pointer variables and dereferences of pointer variables. So this blocking, you could think of dereferences. So it's the, or the, yeah, it's the content of what is pointed at. And, yeah, so that is the computation of the information is, so the result, the ultimate result is a partition. And what can you do with partitions? So clearly, the most precise thing is, or the kind of the best information we might hope for is that everything is unshared. So that means that each pointer and each pointer expression forms a separate equivalence class. So this means nothing is shared. Yeah? So that would be the most precise the optimal information we could hope for. And then in the course of time, what can happen is that certain pointers get may point to the same block. So X and Y may point to the same block. Or X and something inside the block of Y may point to the same block. And that, in this case, two such equivalence classes kind of are joined. Yeah? So the worst thing what could happen is that you join everything, because if you join everything, this means everything could share pointers with any other may point to the same thing like any other thing, and that is kind of then you. So thinking again optimization wise, this means you can do no optimization at all. So that means we compute with such partitions of pointer expressions. And each a partition consists of a set of equivalence classes. These equivalence classes, this is this P1 to PM. And now that is kind of the conceptual thing which we would like to compute with. Now, if we want to practically compute with, we have to the question is, how do we identify a set? Now, The set is we will identify by one representative inside the set. So that is the thing. And now then the operations on such a partition are the following. The first operation is you have any element, this P, and you the partition is pi, and you want to find out in which of the equivalence classes inside a P is inside pi does P lie. Yeah, how can you do it? So the answer should be one of the representatives. Yeah, so the result of that kind of this little p is in the PR is contained in the equivalence class capital PI, then you would like to return that index I or the representative PI of that equivalence class. Yeah, that is the find operation. And then there's a union operation, and the union operation takes a partition and two representatives of equivalence classes inside the partition. These are the little PI1, PI2, and then returns the partition where the equivalence classes of PI1 and PI2 are joined. That's it. So the equivalence relation becomes coarser because there are now less equivalence classes inside the equivalence relation. Yeah. So now, why did I kind of mention the names of the operations? Because this find and union, so that is a union find data structure. And that is kind of a standard algorithmic problem to design a data structure to maintain partitions. And I guess all of you have kind of at some point heard about such data structures. Have you? So if you have studied here, you should have heard about it. So Grundlagen, Algorithmen, Datenstrukturen, you should have heard about that union find data structure. If not, it's such a nice data structure that one can easily explain it here. And I will do it just to remind you and to tell you that these kind of algorithmic tricks and data structures, and these are so such basic data structures are so convenient, and then so by that you see they really show up in practice. So that is at least something which you could learn here. Partitions, so there are practical problems like here to do this alias analysis where you have to maintain partitions, and then it should make click in your head, and then I know partitions, there's this data structure, I use it. That's it. That's the message. And I guess in practice you have already, when you did any kind of programming, you have already made that experience. And if not, I guess you will definitely make that experience all the way in your academic and otherwise career. So now let's see assume we have such kind of a union find data structure. What else would we have to do? So we first have to observe that if X and Y are equivalent, so this is they may point to the same thing, then that means that if they contain the same block, that also if I look at the blocks referenced by X and X1 and X2, then they also could be the same and therefore equivalent. So therefore we have kind of a closure operator. Once we have identified X1 and X2, we also have to identify X1 box and X2 box. So that is the first thing. And then the other thing which we would like to kind of take care of is that if an equivalence class contains some variable, then we choose the representative of one of the variables. So that is a useful this is a useful convention, because if we do that, we have to do this to find out whether an equivalence class contains a variable, then is no longer very difficult. We just look at the representative. because if the representative is a variable, okay, then the equivalence class may contain variables. Otherwise, it only contains dereferences of variables. Okay, and now here you find how we would. So we do not only need this union, but since if x and x1 and x2 are equivalent, we also have to equate x1 dereferenced and x2 dereferenced. So therefore, whenever we do a union, we have to kind of recursively close it. So therefore, we have to do the following. I suggest to introduce the following operation. This is this union star operation. It takes a partition pi and two q1 and elements q1 and q2. And these are any elements. Any variables or variable dereferences. And then we first find the two equivalence classes corresponding to Q1 and Q2. This is this PI1, PI2. And then we check whether these are the same. If these are the same, this means that Q1 and Q2 are already equivalent, and then we do nothing. Okay. Otherwise, we kind of take the union of the two equivalence classes of Q1 and Q2. And now we check additionally. So we do that. And then if one of them, if both of these things which we took, if both of these things which we applied the union operation to were variables, so then we do apply the closure operation, and that means that we apply we call union again for pi and the dereferences of these two variables, and that means if the equivalence classes of these dereferences then again contain variables, that would mean that we apply more and more unions. It definitely will terminate, because the worst thing which can happen is that we put everything into one equivalence class and then nothing happens anymore. Okay? So could you understand this union star thing? So maybe I draw one more picture. So here here's the X. Here is the Y. And then we have to, which we put in an equivalence class, and now we have this X box, and now I write here over that other stuff the Y box, which we also might equate. And it might happen that X box is already equivalent to Z, and that is equivalent to Z prime. So we have these two equivalence classes already before. So that was an equivalence class, that was an equivalence class. Now we have to merge these two equivalence classes, and that means in particular we have to equate the Z and the Z prime, and then continue. That is the phenomenon which could happen here. Okay. So now the analysis proceeds as follows. So for the recall, if we did this points to analysis with the sets, we had to do a fixed point iteration. So we looked at each edge, but we would have to iterate several times. Now this one is more simple. It iterates also over all edges of the control flow graph, but considers each edge exactly once. Because if you once have equated something, then it's equated, and you need not equate the same thing once more. Yeah? So therefore, each edge is considered exactly once. So this makes it a very fast analysis. And for each... So here is what you do whenever you consider an edge. So if you have... let's see... If x equals y, then you simply equate x and y. So then they may point to the same thing. They have the same values. and therefore they are the same, and also everything which is recursively reachable, so therefore this union star. if you have a memory read, then you equate X and Y dereferenced. If you have a memory write from X, you do the same. And in all other cases, you do nothing. You see, it's now a very simple and very trivial analysis. Yeah. Now let's see what happens with that in our. So we have now a super duper ingenious analysis, which is very simple. Let's see what it pays us, whether it pays off. And you see also there that this is an analysis which you can do for large code bases. And that's therefore, if people do in compilers, even dealing with Linux kernel and I don't know, Windows something, and with millions of lines of code, that kind of analysis you can always very quickly do. And in some cases, you get even meaningful information. So here is the analysis for that. A run of the analysis for that simple example to the left. So we start out with a situation where every variable and every dereference of a variable, so where is constitutes a distinct equivalence class. Then we process the step 0 to 1. Okay, so nothing happens. 1 to 2, nothing happens, because that is just assignments. So it does not equate any variables. Now comes the situation 2 to 3. At 2 to 3, this is the first time where something interesting happens, because there Y moves into the block pointed to by X. So that means Y and the dereference of X becomes equated. And then we proceed from 3 to 4, then again nothing happens. So that's all. Okay? And that gives us the resulting equivalence relation, and you see it is nice and precise and everything is fine. Okay, now let's look. So that was an indication that in some cases the result is not so stupid, but there are other situations where the result is a little far less informative. So let's look at our pointer reversal algorithm for list reverse. And again, we start out with an equivalence relation where every individual variable or dereferenced variable constitutes its own equivalence relation. And then we proceed, let us process now the edges 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, and 5 to 6, because these are the edges, so these ones, where something interesting happens. So each of them constitutes kind of some unification, some union of equivalence relations. So the first 2 to 3 will equate H and T. So therefore, it introduces the equivalence class H, T. And also due to this union star thing, H box and T box. Okay, now H-box and T-box. And then now we have this in the next step, the T and the T dot zero, the T-box with offset zero are equated in the from 3 to 4. Therefore, we have to equate that H and that, this was exactly not what one has to do, so let me kind of correct. So the T with the T dereferenced. And that means we have to take the union of these two yellow equivalence classes, which therefore provides us with that equivalence class. So now again, we would have to do this union star thing. So if there were a variable inside that if there were, no, what do we have to do? It's not the case. So there is, it's not the case that in the left argument of the union and the right argument in the union both contain variables. This is not the case. Only one contains variable. So therefore the union star is just the union here. So that was the result after traversing or processing the edge 3 to 4. Now comes the edge 4 to 5. And there we have to equate H box, H dereferenced and R. So R is here. And H, so that means we have to, here is the H, where is it? H box, that is here. And R is here. So these two equivalence classes must be joined, giving one single equivalence class, which now is this one. So that means we already have kind of joined everything into one equivalence class. And so if then we proceed from 5 to 6, which would additionally join R and H, R and H, they are already in the same equivalence class, so nothing happens anymore. Yeah, so that we are done. Everything is in one class, everything is safe, everything is fine, no information. On the other, so that might be in the depressing in the first sight, but the pointer fiddling here is so complicated that it's very difficult for any pointer analysis to find out more. And the only thing what we can learn from that here is if we have kept by naming conventions, the variables manipulating the list separate from the variables manipulating another list, which serves a different purpose, then the analysis would in the end create two clusters, one cluster for the one list and one cluster for the other list, and that's fine. And at least these two clusters would not share references. And that's fine if the two lists are unshared. So in that sense, this is a in some sense, it is a depressing result, but in some sense also somehow you have to invest quite a bit effort to get better results. And and compilers typically do not invest more into pointers than this. Yeah. And here you once again we should note that in the beginning we assume that in the beginning of the analysis we assume that all variables are distinct, and that corresponds to a start state of the program where even if blocks are uninitialized, then they at least do not contain references to each other. Or if they do, we never retrieve these addresses before the particular locations, the corresponding locations have been initialized. That is, so we may kind of consider the program as starting with initialized blocks and blocks which are kind of nullified before or at allocation, and that kind of is a prerequisite with which implicitly is done by any kind of meaningful analysis of that type. Because if we started with top, then we would start with everything could point to everything in the beginning, and we would never recover from such a bad state. Now, what is the complexity of this of now our ingenious alias analysis? So we have to traverse somehow every edge once, and then additionally we also have to do the, well, now how often do we have to union for each edge? We might consider each variable, so at least all together a union operation can only be executed for each variable or each variable at most once. Each variable or variable dereference. So one of these, an address can only take part only once, essentially only once in the union. So therefore, it is just the sum of the edges and the variables. And so therefore, in the end, and the number of find operations, that is the number of union operations. No, sorry, I must say it in a different way. how often, so the number of edges has to be considered, each edge has to be consulted at least once, that is for sure. The other thing is, now how many union operations can I have? And here I claim that it is bounded by the number of variables, or say twice the number of variables. Why? Because whenever I do a union, and that means that I have two disjoint equivalence classes. Now, in the beginning, I have 2n, if n is the number of variables, 2n equivalence classes. After each union, you decrease the number of equivalence classes by 1. And so the number of union operations altogether can only be 2n minus 1, because then you have everything joined together. Yeah. So therefore, this the number of required union operations and union star operations, therefore, is simply bounded by the number of variables. So this makes it, and it's an additive. So it's not a multiplicative thing, but it's an additive thing. So therefore, it is really the number of unions is really not so high, and the number of finds also. And now, so that is the total number of union operations. And this is the total number of union star operations where, most of the union star operations will then result in nothing. So now everything depends on how often, how expensive is a find and how expensive is the union operation. And that is now a general data structure problem, a plain data structure problem, and we have simply to decide how do we represent what is a decent union find data structure. And just for pleasure and for the refreshment, we might recall how we would do it. So how would we do it? So I guess what if you look up a textbook, then they would represent a partition as a directed forest. And so how do we realize a directed forest? So for each element in the, you maintain a reference to its father. And when you follow the path through this father reference, you at some point reach the root. And the root is identified by setting the father reference to the root itself. So that's the simple idea. And so this father reference you could kind of encode in a simple way by, if the U is a range of numbers, say 0 to n minus 1, then you could represent that partition by just an array of that size, of size n. And in this sense, a single tree represents, so here I kind of skipped the self loops, so here I should think of, you should think of that there's always a reference to itself. So each of these trees constitutes an equivalence class of the partition. And down there you see the yellow things are the indices of the array, or put it differently, the elements of the universe which are partitioned, and the father link is the content of the array. So that is, so you see one zero is mapped to one, so the ancestor of zero is one, the ancestor of this, the father of one, is one itself, so that is one is the root. And So by that, 3 points to one, because and 2 points to three. So in that sense, this one gives this tree. And here the four, this one gives that tree, and this one is the representation of this tree. 5 points to seven, 6 points to five, and 7 points to itself. So this is a nice representation of a partition. And if you if you want to find the representative for a node U, you only have to follow the father links. So that is, you have to repeatedly look up the value of U in U in. So you look up the value of U in the table, and that gives you an element, and you repeat until you reach an element which whose index coincides with its value. So that's it. So that's the find operation and the union operation. Okay, so how do we do it? You have two trees like these. Here are two trees, and then you kind of have to 4 points to has the value 4 down here. And 7 has the value 7. So now you can decide either to put to redirect 4 to 7 or to 7 to 4. And then you have a removed one representative and joined two equivalence classes. So what would one do here better? Is it better to put 7 below 4 or 4 below 7? Hmm? Sure, one has to do 4 below 7. Why? Hmm? I didn't understand what? So the other was, so the problem is, if one wants to do fast find, then the paths should be short. And if I put 7 below 4, then the path from 6 to the root will be extended, will become one longer. While, if I put 4 below 7, then the find for 4 becomes more expensive, but that's overall paths do not grow. So that is the method of choice. So in general, the cost of a union then would be O of 1. And the cost of a find would be depth of the forest. And now clearly, this would not be the end. If you ask these algorithm guys, they would not sleep nor rest until they squeeze the utmost efficiency out of the problem. And so in that, the obvious way to increase precision, not precision, but efficiency, is to try to shrink the depth of trees to make them as flat as possible. And that is, there are two tricks to shrink the depth of tree, or to bound the depth of trees. One idea is to always put the smaller tree below the bigger one. And the smaller tree is so you really count the number of elements in the tree, and that you keep track. So whenever you put one tree under the other, you can at the root store the number of nodes in the tree, because you simply have to add two numbers, so that's easy. And so you always know which tree is smaller than the other, and that you put below the root of the other one. And this trick alone results in that the tree, if you have a tree of, if you have a forest with n nodes, then paths never will be longer than log n. So this makes finding logarithmic. So this is a great idea. But then one could do a second trick, and that is this trick here, that if I traverse a path, then I have visited all the nodes and I know about that path, and everything which is on that path I could put directly below the root. This is kind of path compression. So here is the first trick. So this trick is putting a smaller node below a larger one that we have already employed. I only have to maintain the sizes to kind of make this decision. And the path compression is this one here. If I find a 6, so this is while the putting a smaller one below a larger one, this is an improvement of the union. Now we do an improvement of the find. And here, if I walk up to the root, I record the elements I have encountered and put all of them below the root. Yeah? Put all of them below the root, and that is kind of makes, this find is not, this particular find is not improved. It is even, its cost is kind of doubled, but this investment pays off for all future finds, because then paths become much smaller. And the person who came up with that kind of is a very old idea already, I guess. I don't know, I guess from the 70s, even before. So that was the high time of Tarjan, and he provided a lot of such kind of algorithms. So this union find algorithm has then, in the end, is, I guess, the idea of this algorithm, so therefore I like it so much, is you can explain it extremely quickly and it's immediately intuitive. The analysis of it is not so immediate. In particular, there is something like, so you have the number of, the cost is the overall of a number of union operations, and the number of find operations is you have each union essentially costs O of 1, and each find operation costs essentially 1, but then scale, then there comes another factor, which is this inverse Ackermann function. To have an analysis returning such kind of result is ingenious, and I guess that is what Tarjan provided. And this inverse Ackermann function is so slowly growing that for all practical uses, it is, I think, less than 7 or so, or even less, I think less than 7. And this, for all practical uses, this means whenever n is less than the number of atoms in the universe, then it's less than 7. So that means for all practical uses, it's a constant. Yeah? Okay, so that was the implementation of this union find. So now we have this, so this was kind of a detour, just as a little bit of exercise to refresh our information about data structures. Okay, so now this is a good, but at least for me, this is a good point to kind of make another, so we had now a detour, so why not doing another detour? So here we kind of invested quite some effort to improve, to get a fast implementation of this particular sort of alias analysis. So this was definitely worthwhile to have a nice algorithm there, but we as well might now consider our working horse, our round robin algorithm. Is this really the best thing which we can do? So, because everything, every analysis which we had so far essentially relied on that fixed point computation. And therefore, if this fixed point algorithm is, if we plug in a faster fixed point algorithm, then we will benefit from that. And so I may kind of, I'm not sure whether I kind of related that little anecdote to you, but for some time this Java bytecode verification was based on round robin iteration. Did I relate that? Sorry to you? No, I guess I didn't. And and this quadratic behavior which we had here. So quadratic behavior, I mean, so you, if you have a lattice, say you have sets of size M, then you have one round of round robin iteration, means you have to look at the program, all of the program once, this costs N, and times the height of the lattice, and then you have to repeat how often. Well, the height of the lattice means that if the height of the lattice is H, at each program point values may be increased H times each, and there are n program points, so you have n times h times n, so n squared times h. That is the complexity of the algorithm. And so, if you have a large program, then n squared is painful. And if the height of the lattice is non-trivial, then you have another factor, and you kind of notice that. And you can now, we can say, okay, if the ordering, we always said, had such an argument, if we choose the ordering well, then round robin iteration is not so bad. But then people came up with attacks to the, not attacks, but at least challenges to the Java compiler by writing programs where the control flow graph is so weird that this bytecode verification never terminated. Or it terminated, but it took so long that your computer was blocked for hours. And due to this quadratic behavior, because quadratic can be a killer in if your program is reasonably large. And now, what is bytecode verification? What do they do? They make some sanity checks that you never use a variable which has not been declared, that the level of that you really have that in the body of a function, the stack increases, the stack point increases as much as it decreases. So that these kind of sanity checks, and also think that at every control flow path you hit a return or things like that. So that's kind of sanity checks bytecode verification provides you with, and that was just implemented by round robin iteration, and it was a killer. And so there one might wonder, is really round robin iteration the best thing what you can do? And now, in order to kind of improve on the inefficiencies, one clearly has to spot them first. So the first spot of inefficiency is this one. So round robin iteration proceeds in iterations. And when does it stop? If during a whole iteration there was no change. But that means that's on the good side, you detect termination, but it's on the bad side. You have to look at the whole program somehow to make a full iteration just to detect that you are done. So the last iteration is simply doesn't compute anything meaningful anymore. Okay, so this is one iteration. One might say, okay, so this will not save the world, but still it's an inefficiency. So, and then it is so, it could happen that in some round, so that is the first thing, that in some round, you may change only a single unknown in your system. And then you have to do the full iteration again. And so one unknown corresponds to us for one program point. There's a change. And you have to go through the whole program this single value which has changed may propagate to the next, along the control flow edge to the next point in the program. But still you have to go through all of the program and make so little progress. And that is clearly annoying. This is the main cause. In some sense, one might say this is the main reason why round robin iteration may be very slow. And then another practical thing is that this you have to do. Everything depends on finding. The only way to tune the algorithm is to choose an ordering of the variables. And if you make a wrong choice, then you are dead. Well, you are not dead, but it takes awfully long. So then, and such kind of, if it is a little bit brittle. Yeah, it depends on the heuristics which you use for naming the variables, and somehow one would prefer algorithms which are more robust. So it doesn't matter how you name or number your variables. Yeah, and that is particularly the case because there were analyses, please recall, which were forward and others were backward. And then we also had, if you have the ordering which is good for forward iteration, it might be bad for backward iteration. So this means from forward iteration to backward iteration, you have to change the number of the ordering of your variables. Which is, you can do it, no problem, but it's a nuisance and you have to implement it. and you perhaps do not want to do it. You want to have something which kind of works no matter what you do. You just throw it into your algorithm and it is fast as hell. So that is the thing which I would like to have. And so the people came, so this is also, I guess, I'm not sure who ever invented that. It is some, I guess this is an idea which is also virtually as old as this round robin iteration. This is this worklist iteration. I guess this is also from the late 70s at least. So what is the idea? The idea is in some sense very natural. Whenever some variable changes, I only I check which other variables depended on that, and then I trigger the reevaluation of these variables, and only of these. Yeah. So that is the idea. So that is we enhance our fixed point algorithm to take dependencies between variables into account. So that is for every right-hand side f of a variable xi, assume that this right-hand side is fi, I assume that I am given the number of unknowns which are accessed during that evaluation. And this will not be all variables. Think of our control flow analysis, or our control flow graphs and our what kind of analysis we did there. So if I had a program point V, from which other program points, if I want to compute the information for program point V, the information of which program points may contribute to it, only the ingoing edges. So these are 5, 6, or perhaps even just 2 or 1 other program point. So it's not so that all program points immediately contribute to V, it's only 1 or 2 or 3 or something, but a small number. Yeah? And that is kind of a crucial point, so that is our dependency graph is not dense, it's very sparse. So we assume that we are given these dependencies for every right-hand side Fi. And in our application, these dependencies are very explicit because we just look at the control flow graph, we see the dependencies. Yeah? Okay, and then we could, instead of looking at the dependencies, so where does Xi, where does it depend on? I take the other point of view, I look at the influences. So the dependencies are the ingoing edges and the influences are the outgoing edges. Yeah, so that is the influence set of Xi is the set of variables which notice a change in the Xi. So these are those variables where the Xi occurs in the right hand side or is in this depth thing. So this I of X. So that will be the thing which the which our algorithm will then take care of. Okay, and then now then we kind of assume that for the d of x, so d is an array indexed by the variables which we want to compute. So this should receive the values, the result of our fixed point algorithm, of our fixed point computation, and initially the d values will be set to bottom. So that is the start of the fixed point algorithm. And then now the only, as I said, it is a worklist iteration. So the only data structure what we kind of maintain is a list W. And W should remind you of worklist. And that contains the set of variables whose value the work. So those which we have to still the right-hand side to be evaluated. So then initially the worklist should contain all variables. So that's the first thing. And then as long as this W is non-empty, I have to do some work. As soon as the work list drops to the empty set or the empty list, we know all work has been executed and the fixed point has been reached. At least this is our hope. So now assume that we have some work. So that is W contains some variables. Then we may extract one of these variables. So this is this XI. So extracting means we take it out, and so it's no longer in the list. And then we evaluate the right-hand side with the current variable assignment. So FI, assume that FI is a kind of a function taking, so it's an expression, and we evaluate that expression with respect to the values of variables, and this eval is this function, so I assume that I have a thinking, I just leave it like that. And here down there is how I would like. So the eval is a function, is a variable assignment, if you like. It kind of, for every variable, it returns the value, the current value which we have for that variable. The current value for that variable is stored somewhere in the array. And then using this mapping, so the eval. The eval is a mapping from variables to values, indeed. And the F, the right-hand side FI, for example, is considered as a mapping which takes such a mapping and returns a value. So in our case, the FI receives the values for x1 to x2, x3, x4. You could think of it as providing it as a tuple, but that is perhaps an inconvenient thing. You might more generally assume it is an expression which you have to evaluate given the values for the variables. So in that sense, it is of that functionality as I wrote down here. Yeah? Can you kind of understand this little amount of formalism which I have here? So once again, so now that says, okay, if I have this variable I take some piece of work and I do this work. This means I process that variable. This means I evaluate the right-hand side. This is this yellow beast. And then I check whether I made some progress or not. So whether this right-hand side changes the world. So if it changes when does it change the world? It changes the world if the value returned is different from the old value. So it's not subsumed by the value which we had before. So the old value was stored in D sub XI. If the new value is not subsumed by that, so if it's less or equal to that, then I'm done. But if it's larger or if it's incomparable, then I say, okay, so the value D sub XI, D of XI is not yet the right value. I have to increase the value. And here is the increase of value which I do. I just do the least upper bound of the old value and the new value, and that is the new value for the XI. Okay, so that is kind of, now I have processed the X. But in this case, the value of X has changed, and now I have to propagate the change. Because now, for the other variables which in this set, in this I of X, these are the variables which sense which possibly depend on that on the value of the current variable, and so the value of the current variable has changed. So I may kind of inform these. Please check whether your right hand side is still whether this constraint is still satisfied. So please reevaluate yourself. And therefore, these are simply added to the work list. Okay, that's all, and that we do until the work list is empty. Okay, is it clear how that is? So these worklist algorithms, I think in other cases it all also occurs, so you have a possibility tasks which are generated by some generator, and then you have some worker which kind of extracts and does the work. And doing the work perhaps generates more work. And that's the case here. Yeah, and then you kind of, then the workers, in this case one worker, operates as long as it works until the worklist is empty. So clearly there is room for parallel processing here, because you might say, instead of having only one worker, you could have several workers. So that means you could kind of parallelize such kind of fixed point iteration by using by realizing the work list by some task queue in Java, for example. So that would be something what one could try to see whether that would really speed up the analysis. Okay, so now let's check. So now, now let's see how this algorithm works. And I must say, I don't know whether you recall, when I advertised round-robin iteration, I did not advertise it for its efficiency, but for its ease of presentation, because I could fill in these tables and then put one row after the other, one column besides the other, and by that kind of indicated you the progress of the fixed point computation, and you could easily follow. For this worklist iteration, it's much more complicated to follow, to understand what the algorithm does. It's faster, but it's more difficult to understand its operational behavior. So here I have a small benchmark constraint system, three variables, x1, x2, x3. I guess we used that already for round robin iteration. The lattice is the power set of ABC. And the set of influences, now here you see the x1 influences the x3, but nothing else. And the x2, where is the x2? The x2 influences nothing. It only occurs on the left-hand side. And the x3 influences the x1, and it influences the x2. Yeah? So that is here. Now here is where I tried to visualize the behavior of the fixed point algorithm. So initially, the worklist contains all the variables. Then I extract the first, so they are there, it's a list, and take the head of the list. So that is the x1. Now initially the values for all the unknowns in the system are bottom, which is the empty set in our case. So now I evaluate the x1. So this means I evaluate the right hand side of x1 with the current values for the variables. So this gives me the value a. A for x1. So as a consequence, I notice, X1 must be updated. I make an update. So now X1 is updated. So then I check what other variables are influenced by X1. So, that is X3. So I have to add X3 to the worklist. Now you notice the first kind of thing, which was kind of a little bit stupid with the algorithm. I have to add it to the worklist, but it's already in there. So somehow, so there are two possibilities. Either I add it a second time, notwithstanding that it is already there. In fact, for the complexity, it doesn't matter. But from a practical point of view, this is ridiculous. So therefore, we might additionally keep an array with a flag telling us whether something is in the worklist or not. If it is there, we kind of do not add it. If it is not there, we set the flag and add it. By that, we kind of can avoid inserting duplicates into the worklist. So here, I kind of preferred to not to introduce duplicates into the worklist. That means I add nothing to the worklist. Okay. So now we now extract the next element from the worklist, which in this particular case is that one. Now we evaluate x2. So let me kind of wipe out these things which we had here. So now we consider x2. This one. And that is X3 intersected AB. X3 at the moment is the empty set. So the result is the empty set intersected with something which is the empty set. So the value of X2 does not change. So it stays the same. So now we are here. It stays the same. And so nothing is added to the worklist. Yeah, so we simply proceed. So we simply proceed with X3. This is the remaining element in our super duper worklist. Okay, now evaluating X3 takes the value of X1 and adds C to it, which gives AC. AC, this is a new value. So therefore we have to, the value of X3 has changed. Everything which depends on X3 must be added to the worklist. So therefore now the worklist, the X3 is removed from the worklist, but X1, X2 is added. So therefore now we are at that situation. Okay? And so that we proceed by extracting, by taking the X1 from the worklist. X1 will evaluate again this A union X3. Now A union X3 gives us AC, implying that the value of X1 also now increases from, again increases, namely from A to AC. Okay, so the value of X1 has changed. So therefore, according to our influence set, we have to add X3 to the worklist. Before we had X1, X2. X1 is removed, stays X2. Then we have to add X3, and we add X3. And you notice, now the question is, where do I add this X3 into the worklist? I could put it in front, I could put it in the back. So this matter, if it is a list, I still have the possibility to maintain it as a queue or as a stack. And here, for simplicity, I maintain it as a stack. And in fact, one can make a little experiment. The stack is preferable, but it's only, it doesn't matter too much. But at least it is, for certain reasons, it is preferable. So therefore, we simply put it on front. Yeah. So for this type of algorithm, it's not so bad if you use the simplest possible data structure, which is a stack. For a queue, you have to maintain two pointers, one to the beginning, one to the end. For a stack, you only have to maintain one pointer to the beginning. Yeah. So therefore, a stack is easier, and we use the simplest possible data structure here. So that is the stack. So we put the X3 on front, and that means in the next go, we have again to evaluate the X3. So the X3 now, evaluating the X3, evaluating X3, here is it, X3. We have to add C to X1, and then we notice, oh, this does not change the value of X. So we get now this one, this value. It is the same as before, no change. And that means nothing is added to the worklist, but the worklist only shrinks by removal of X3. And so in the end, we only have this X2 in the worklist, which we finally evaluate. The X2, evaluating the X2, evaluating the X2 takes X3, intersects with AB, which gives us A. So therefore now we have this value here. And since the influence set of X2 is empty, so we are done. We do add nothing to the worklist. The worklist has been emptied, so altogether we are now done. So detection of the termination of the fixed point algorithm is very easy. And you see, altogether we have computed this value here. And that is, in fact, the least solution. It says, yeah, that is the same least solution which we had for round-robin iteration. And the number of updates, the number of evaluations of right-hand sides which we had is only 6. And I think before that we had, so I don't recall, but I guess we had more evaluations. Six is just two rounds of round-robin iteration, and I guess we needed at least a third round to establish that we have reached the fixed point. So it's a significant decrease, even for this microscopic example, which proves nothing, but at least gives an indication that it is a worthwhile algorithm. So is there a question to this algorithm? Could you kind of follow? I think it's a very natural algorithm. So here's the theorem which tells us something about the quality of the algorithm, and that is the following. Assume that we have... So this is now is again a general theorem, but it applies also to our situation. The general theorem says is a statement about any system of constraint systems of this type. One constraint for each unknown. There are n unknowns. And the height of the lattice, that is the number of updates, which you increases, which you could do for values, is h. And assume that this is bounded by some, that this is h. So this is the, there could be less updates, but h is the maximal number. So, and that is the number of updates which you can make for an individual variable. So think of content propagation. What was h there? Twice the number of program variables. Because each program variable could go from a value 5 to top. And if you have 20 program variables, this can happen 20 times. So therefore, height is 20. And life variables, how high? What was the height of the lattice? If you have 100 variables, each variable could be added, so it's the number of variables. Yeah, so then you could increase the value 100 times. So that's the height. Now then the claim is the algorithm terminates after a number of iterations, of evaluations of right-hand sides, which is bounded by n times h. So, and n, this capital N is not the number of variables, but the size of the system. If you decide, what is the size of the system? How do we measure the size of the system? The size of the system we measure by saying, okay, the size of the system is the sum of the sizes of all constraints, and the single constraint we count as 1 plus the size of the right-hand side. Now, what is the size of the right-hand side? Here I say it's just the number of variables onto which this right-hand side depends. So if it has 5 variables, I have to look at each variable, so it contributes 5. At least. So then I have to do the evaluation, but at least I have to look at these variables, so therefore it is meaningful to take that into account. And thinking of our programs, so what is this, the right-hand side is given by the, essentially given by the predecessor, the ingoing edges. And the ingoing edges, so that is here we sum over all in degrees of variables, and if you sum over all in degrees of variables, you get the number of control flow edges. So this capital N is the number of one, well, it is essentially, so you have this sum here, which gives the number of control flow edges, and you have this one here, this is the number of program points. So it's the, altogether, this N is the size of the control flow graph. And this is meaningful, you have to, that this matters. And you multiply that size of the control flow graph times H. And in fact, one can, so it's, in practical programs, the size of the control flow graph corresponds virtually is the same as the size of the program points, because every program point has only one or two outgoing edges. So the number is at most twice the number of program points. The size is twice or no, three times. It's about three times the size of the number of program points, this capital N. Okay, so that is, so in that sense, we see that this number here is more or less the number of program points, and this H is something, the number of updates, and you only multiply by that. And compare, for round-robin iteration, we had h times n squared. So we save one square here. And so that is the complexity statement. And if your program has 1,000 program points, this is a factor of 1,000 which you save. And a factor of 1,000 is significant. So this is not just from square, linear, that's all polynomial. So it's not like that. So this is a factor that matters. And the other thing is, now that is about, that was the statement about complexity, but now clearly whenever we have an algorithm, we also would like to have that the algorithm is correct. And that means it should kind of solve the problem. That is, it should compute the least fixed point, the least solution. And that is the case as soon as the right-hand sides are monotonic. Now in all our applications, the right-hand sides have been monotonic, and therefore this algorithm will compute the least solution. Okay, so now that's now I have a theorem, and in principle we now have to provide a proof. So perhaps let us consider this complexity thing, because that might be perhaps you find it, or at least I always find it amazing that you can so easily save one factor just by using a work list instead of the round robin thing, and this one factor of n. So here is the argument why this is the case. So the first thing is, each variable xi may change its, how often may it change its value? Well, whenever it changes, the value will become larger. So therefore, it may change its value at most h times. Okay, that means that the list I of xi can be added to, will be added to the work list at most h times. Yeah? And so then the simple argument is, if you can only extract variables from the unknowns xi from the work list if they have been added there before. So the number of extractions is the same as the number of insertions. So this means the total number of evaluations is bounded. Okay, so initially we put n elements into the work list, and then we put h times this infill of xi into the work list for summing the sum over all variables. So that's all the insertions and therefore all the extractions, and that is the number of evaluations we can maximally have. And you see here, we don't, this calculation is extremely robust. We don't take into account that some things could be added multiple times. This would not destroy this calculation. So because we here simply take all of the I of X I and put it into the work list, no matter whether it is there or not. Yeah. So this little improvement by putting variables into the work list only if they are not there will greatly improve on, practically improve on that worst case asymptotic calculation. So now let's see. Now we have the formula, and the rest is kind of a little bit of symbol pushing. So the first thing which we note here, if we want to simplify that formula here on the right hand side, this h kind of can be pulled out. So this gives us then the next line, which is this one. So now we may check, then we have the sum. What is this sum? We sum over all outgoing edges of variables, if you like. So, and that is the same as the number of all ingoing edges. So summing over the infill sets is the same as summing over the depth sets. And this then we do another thing. If we have here now this n times h, n plus h times something, and now we could say, okay, n times h, uh, Here we have summing. So if you kind of make a... So I claim that I can, instead of having this n separately out here, I can put it in there and by that pull the h out. So this means I put... Essentially, this means I put a factor h here in front. And now clearly, n is less or equal to h times n if h is at least 1. So if you have a lattice which has at least 2 elements, then you may put out this h there. And, well, in that case, I have h times n plus this sum. And now n plus this sum, this n is the sum of n times 1, and that means I can put this n inside here. So if I put it inside, it gives us this 1 plus. Yeah. So by this little kind of microscopic massaging the right-hand side, I ultimately arrive at an expression here, which is n times the size of the system. And that's what we claimed. So, that's all. Is there a question? So that was for the runtime. So it's a little bit of an amortized analysis. And I must say, for you now, this will be natural, and the complexity of the worklist versus round robin algorithm will seem a trifle to you, but I have surprised several times my colleagues who are not from that area. They kind of had a fixed point to compute, and they came up with these naive iteration strategies, and they always had this n squared something, and then I told them, here, it's only linear in the n, and they wouldn't believe it, and that is really amazing. So it's an amazing algorithm, also with an amazing effect, also it seems, when you look in detail as we did here, it is kind of a very simple thing. Okay. Now, why is it correct? So the first thing is that... we have to show that the following thing. The first thing is we have to show that we never go beyond, if assuming that all the right-hand sides are monotonic, we have to show and assume that D0 is the least solution, then we have to show 3 things. The first thing is that we never overshoot the least solution. And then the second thing is that that in the end, all the constraints are satisfied. How can we achieve that? Well, in the end, all the constraints are satisfied if we keep the invariance that all the variables where the constraint currently is not satisfied, that all these variables are contained in W. If this is the case, then we conclude, if this is always the case, when as soon as W becomes empty, then all the constraints must be satisfied, and therefore we have the solution. Yeah? So that from these 2 properties, we therefore conclude whenever the algorithm terminates, it will return a solution, and then it will also return a least solution. Yeah? So why is it the case? So the termination we have proven because the fixed point we calculated even the complexity. That this property holds is, then we, for every step, whenever a variable is updated, we kind of check that this invariant simply is never violated. And the reason is we always kind of replace, assuming that all the values d's are less or equal than the least solution by monotonicity, if you apply a right-hand side, we stay with below the least solution, and therefore all the updates we do will not violate this first invariant, and therefore we never overshoot the least solution. And the other thing is, as soon as a variable initially W contains all variables, therefore also all variables where the constraint is violated. And whenever we do, we change a variable, then perhaps we kind of determine all the constraints which possibly could be violated, and then we add them to the worklist, so that afterwards, indeed, the worklist collects all the variables whose constraints might be violated. So therefore, this is also satisfied, and this gives us the correctness of the algorithm. So, and I guess this is now time to stop. Thank you for your attention, and we meet again next week.